Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's a weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and arts and culture. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Graham Anthony. Good morning. Today, our monthly art and culture segment features Susan Meyer of Meyer Gallery and the president of the Park City Gallery Association. She's joined by Hadley Dynack of the Park City Summit County Arts Council to explore the art of selling art.
And then writer and producer Randy Silverman, whose documentary No Letting Go came to Park City during the 2016 May Mental Health Awareness Month. She, in her work as founder also of the Youth Mental Health Project, focuses on helping parents work with the schools and mental health professionals in getting treatment for their children. Randy Silverman will be in town for a lunch and learn on Monday, October 16th at the Park City Library Community Room. It's sponsored by the Park City School District.
And finally, Phil Gaiman was a pro cyclist from 2009 till 2016, but that's only after he retired from laziness and computer games in 2004 and began to ride a bike to lose weight. There's hope for all of us. Stay tuned to hear about his new book, Draft Animals, Living the Pro Cycling Dream Once in a While.
This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design. Love your home.
G'day, it's Ian from Campos Coffee. Us Aussies really love a summer as much as we love supporting KPCW. We've got Nitro Cold Brew on tap, Affogato's made with Wasatch Creamery Ice Cream, and Mamachari Kombucha made with our Cascara Coffee Cherry. Located above the ice rink at Park City Mountain Resort next to the Adirondack Chairs. CamposCoffee.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Graham Anthony. Well, our monthly arts and culture segment is curated by the Park City Summit County Arts Council and its director, Hadley Dynack. Today and every month, we explore the connection between arts and culture in our mountain community. This morning, Hadley brings with her Susan Meyer, who's the owner of the Meyer Gallery and is the president of the Park City Gallery Association. We're going to explore the art of selling art. And good morning to both of you. Thanks for coming.
Good morning.
Morning.
So, Susan Meyer, you're the owner of Meyer Gallery, one of the really longtime galleries on Main Street here in Park City. It's at 305 Main Street towards the top. As you're going up, it's on the right-hand side in a beautiful historic building. Tell us a little, give us a history of, you know, what it's been like to own the gallery all these years, and when did you start?
Gosh, thanks for asking. My parents bought the building in 1965, and it was, there was not a whole lot going on in the arts district, as we call it now. Those of us in the arts business. Yeah. My parents, you know, ran it as a gallery all the way through there, and they opened up another location down in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is currently still in operating. And I purchased the business from them in 1997, mm-hmm. and they still own the building, which is nice. I have very warm and fuzzy landlords. Yeah. So that's kind of how it got started.
So pretty interesting. The gallery, I always remember this story about when Edgar Stern first came to town and he brought his wife Polly, I believe, for a walk up Main Street. And she wanted to walk in the middle of the street because she was worried that the buildings were going to fall over. They were that decrepit. Was that when your parents had this art gallery on Main Street? It must have been a hard go of it.
Oh yeah. So now here's the secret story. My parents added on the upstairs to the building, but they had to keep the facade, the historic facade. And what the story goes is every brick needed to come down one by one, and every brick was numbered so it would all go back into place. And so at one point, if you drove past the gallery, all you would see is the vault, the old historic vault standing as they rebuilt the building. So fortunately, my wiring and plumbing isn't quite as old as it was in the beginning. So.
Good thing.
So you've been running this gallery for 20 years, personally.
That is right.
And you've seen a lot of competition or colleagues
come
and go over that time.
Yeah.
Has there been any significant trends that you can identify over that time?
Gosh, you know, I think one of the biggest changes is we used to have probably 50% turnover from year to year of the galleries, and now there's a lot of businesses that are you know, galleries that thrive and stay, and there's many of us who've been here for well over 20 years, you know, and so I think it says a lot about our community and the support we get.
So tell us, how many galleries are on Main Street now?
Well, there's on Main Street, there's about 23, and then we have a few other galleries that are off of Main Street, like Julie Nestor mm-hmm. Gallery over there. So,
So do you think there's a threshold of the number of galleries that a town this size can support, or are we driven by a more macro economy? I mean, when things are good, things are good.
Things are good. Well, so, you know, I did a little bit of research, not for this show, but for another thing I was working on, and realized that about 15 years ago, we had 20 galleries in town. So not all of them are quite as big and robust as you might find now. But one of the things that people can understand about the galleries here are some of the galleries are a little bit larger, like mine, for example, that has 40 plus artists in the gallery. But a lot of our galleries are artist owned. So they are, they're selling their own art. Maybe they're their only employee. So there is a certain amount that they have to sell in order to stay operational.
Right. It's got to be hard. Well, but those numbers are interesting because I keep thinking that I'm seeing more and more galleries on Main Street, but really we're not.
No.
I will say, and in my other job, I visit art galleries on Main Street all the time. And so it's been really interesting, my own little survey of art galleries that I've been doing. But a proliferation of photography.
Yeah.
And specifically, the photography, and I don't know if this is a trend or not, but where you're printing onto metal,
mm-hmm.
could be aluminum or mm-hmm. some other type of metal.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that there would be a lot of competition, very difficult to make it there. But what do you think about that?
No, there is a lot of photography on the street, and it's one of the areas in which you do see artist-operated galleries such as David Beavis and Brett Webster. Mm-hmm. They run their own shops and generally have just one employee, and they do work on canvas or aluminum or whatever surface. David does some of his photographs on scarves, you know, mm-hmm. things like that. Whatever will take to the inks and the process beautifully. And I think people enjoy seeing the medium in different forms, like on aluminum.
Interesting. And then I probably know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway because there's probably no one right formula. But some of the galleries go with one sort of theme.
Mm-hmm.
You feel like it's contemporary or it's, you know, Russian art.
Yeah.
But others, like the Mountain Trails Gallery, mm-hmm. they have all kinds of different
right.
things going on.
Right.
And I love it because I feel like, well, there's something for everyone in there. But what do you see? What do you think about the variety.
I love it because, you know, a lot of, I travel around a lot and go to different art markets. I took a big road trip this year up to Montana, and I love going up to the galleries in Montana, but you do see a lot of the smaller towns that where it's almost exclusively Western and wildlife. And in Park City, we have abstract, beautiful abstract, you know, glass, weaving. I mean, you'll see it all, mixed media. I love it, as well as some beautiful Western wildlife, you know. So it's the being in the West, I really do feel like there should be a good representation of the kind of art that represents a Western culture and lifestyle. However, we are a very cosmopolitan art district, so it's fun to... I love having the diversity, and I have it in my own building, so...
How many artists are represented in town here who are locally based?
That's a good question. I certainly represent, the majority of my artists come from the state of Utah, but in terms of like Summit County, I personally don't have any right now, but for example, next door, one of the best-selling artists at Mountain Trails is Richardson, I got that right, who is based out of Camas. And if you walk up and down the street, you'll find a lot of the art galleries employ sales staff who are artists. So it's a lot of, like, both of my employees have art degrees. It's a good way for them to keep their art in the forefront of my gallery and also work in the business.
And I wanted to ask Hadley, what is the connection, if any, between the commercial retail galleries that we have in this town and the public art that you're more inclined to speak to?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that the Arts Council is really about is trying to help the community understand that the creative economy and the arts and culture sector comprises all of these different elements. So it is public art. It is our gallery scene, which is so robust and vibrant, particularly in Park City, but also, you know, growing on the east side. We have many creatives living over there. We have the start of some gallery scene. Katie Stelpflug's Artique Gallery is a collective of local artists that, you know, she is exhibiting and showcasing. We have many creative makers and entrepreneurs, and of course all of our arts and culture nonprofits. So, you know, I think that the Gallery Association and the work that the galleries are doing to bring not only local but national and international artists into our community is incredible.
So along these lines of Graham's question, but kind of branching out into these diverse communities that you visit, Susan, mm-hmm. What do you think, where are we missing the mark here in Park City? Because I do hear a lot, I hear often mm-hmm. from gallery owners, oh, well, in, you know, Crested Butte, they do this, and in Jackson Hole and Santa Fe, they do this, and we ought to do more of that. And it seems to always sort of come back to public art in the sense that Graham is talking about, where there's art out on the streets and in the parks and mm-hmm. things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that would be a fun element. And I know that the galleries would certainly, and local artists would definitely get behind more public art. It just has to be something that the city and the county is enthusiastic about and willing to give permits for and work into the designs, because it is something that artists will always leap at the chance to put their art in a public location.
And Hadley, you had something to say.
Yeah, I would just add that specifically on, you know, the public art point, there are a number of projects actually in the works over the next year that the Park City Public Art Board is looking at. You know, there's a variety of capital projects that are happening, and because of our Percent for Art project, a Percent for Art funding, we've got an allocated set of resources dedicated to bring public art to those places. There's also a number of board directed projects that the Park City Public Art Board is looking at right now on Main Street, as well as, you know, throughout the community. And it's one of the great things about public art is, you know, we can get these large scale capital project funded installations. We can also look at, you know, smaller, more lightweight ways to bring community created public art out into the public. So that's exciting as well.
And just time for one final question, and this is the big elephant in the room. When the Arts and Culture District that is slated for the Bonanza Park area, when that comes online, what's the artist's perspective of that? Will Main Street remain as vibrant with art galleries? Will some of those shift down there and we'll get a new type of commercial, retail spattering on Main Street?
Gosh, that's a great question. I'm so excited about what is planned, and I think it'll be such an asset to the community. I don't think that it will impact the retail aspect of the visual arts too much, and I certainly hope that there is some growth down beyond Main Street. However, we do have a few galleries down in that area right now. Bambi Knight is down there making her beautiful custom jewelry, and Julie Nestor and such. So what makes our community unique outside of so many communities is we can walk from the top of Main Street all the way down to the proposed art district or the new art district that will soon be in one beautiful afternoon, and see so much in terms of visual. There's going to be film. There'll be just dance. There's so much going on that our community gets to enjoy. And I have to tell you, if you were to reside in Beaver Creek or Vail, really you need to go to Denver to experience the kind of culture that we get to enjoy in our special little community here.
Yeah, that's a great point. Thanks for making it. From Vinto at the bottom of Main Street to, Julie Nestor Gallery is probably just over a half mile. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. you're really, I think people lose that. They think mm-hmm. that there's this isolated pod and that isolated pod, but not so. Mm-hmm. Susan Meyer, the Meyer Gallery and the president of the Park City Gallery Association, along with Hadley Dynacht of the Park City Summit County Arts Council. Thank you so much for joining us for this month's segment of Arts and Culture here in Park City. And we will be right back after these words. We're moving into a very important topic in our community, a very timely topic, and that is mental health awareness. When we return, stay with us. It's The Mountain Life.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, Park City resident and KPCW fan. Our practice offers solutions for knee and shoulder problems to enjoy the active Park City lifestyle. More information is available on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
This is Nanette Bush with Fairway Independent Mortgage, supporter and longtime listener of KPCW. Fairway Independent Mortgage offers personal home, vacation home, and investment property lending. Our mortgage team partners with local realtors to provide our clients with resources to understand the home finance process. Located at 1700 Park Avenue or at nanettebush.com.
This is The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Graham Anthony. Well, Connect Summit County, in partnership with the Park City School District, will host a free lunch and learn featuring our next guest, Randy Silverman. She is with the Youth Mental Health Project, and she's coming to town Monday, October 16th from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. in the community room at the Park City Library. Randy Silverman is one of the nation's leading voices on youth mental health. She's also the co-writer and producer of the award-winning film No Letting Go. Randy speaks as a parent to other parents, and she tells of her own family struggles and ultimate success to find help for her son's mental illness. She joins us now by phone. Randy Silverman, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you, Lynn and Graham. It's so nice to be here. I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, we're happy that you can come to Park City next month. As you know, this community, and I have to give so much credit to Connect Summit County, who has really illuminated mental health in the community, and especially among our youth. And it's been coming around over the last couple of years. I know you're aware of that. And I'd love to just start with a little bit of your background and your history in your family.
Oh, sure. First, I just want to say Connect has done an amazing job. I've actually been following them, the couple of the co-founders of that organization, and I spoke, I think, maybe 2 years ago when they were starting out. And so I have been a big fan following the work that they're doing there in Park City. It's very, very impressive, and it's very timely, as you said earlier. So as for me, my background is I was a long time ago a lawyer. I joke that I'm in recovery from being a lawyer. But then I was a stay-at-home mom for many years. I was lucky enough. And but I was a young mother who did not know that children could struggle with their mental health or have any kind of diagnosable mental illness, for that matter, for no apparent reason. And so when my son, at a very, very young age, started showing signs and symptoms of first anxiety and depression, I had no idea what to do because I didn't know that that was even possible. And so ultimately, he became very ill and was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And we went through a very painful and difficult 7-year struggle to get him the proper diagnosis and the help he needed. Excuse me. And so that experience really, you know, propelled me into advocacy work. Sorry, go ahead. You had a question.
Well, it just leads me into the whole question about, you know, back when your son got a diagnosis, what did schools understand at that time and what was their responsibility versus, you know, what it would be like now if you went for some help to your public school?
Well, it's really interesting question. Because of my legal background, I was really able to dive into the issues around school. But I didn't know, for instance, that if your child has a serious mental health concern, that the schools actually could be helpful. In fact, I would say that the shame and the blame and the stigma around having a child with a mental health disorder was so intense that I didn't even want to tell anybody at school. So, you know, I isolated and hid a lot of information because I felt that it was a home problem and it had to be really a result of my bad parenting. And initially when I did go to the school, they felt the same way. I said, well, you know, this is really a parenting problem. You know, we're not seeing any problems at school. My son never misbehaved at school. He was a perfect angel at school, but he would come home and it would be a completely different story. So at first, they were very unaware, and the teachers didn't know, and even the special ed department really didn't know how to help. And I really attribute that to just lack of knowledge. It's not that they didn't want to help. It's that they really weren't understanding how to help. And that has changed dramatically. My son was first very, very ill at 8 or 9 years old. So he's now 21 and doing well, but the school districts have really changed. But I also want to say that it depends on each school district. It's very much a district-by-district thing as to how much they understand. Now, by law, if your child is not functioning and is severely impaired, regardless of what that impairment is, you know, special education departments do have to help to a certain degree by federal law, but it does depend on your local school district's understanding and willingness to help. I've heard amazing things about Park City School District, so from what I can hear, it's a pretty good place to be.
Hi, Randy. This is Graham, and I wanted to ask how this falls in line with the recent initiatives to mainstream children of all types and to increase diversity in the classroom?
That's a really good question. There's a movement for inclusion is what you're talking about.
Yes.
And I have mixed feelings about it, albeit perfectly honest with you. First of all, I believe in inclusion, and I believe in diversity, and I believe that we all need to learn to accept all of the differences that there are. My primary message about mental health is we need to teach our children that we all have mental health. Mental health begins with birth, and taking care of it begins very early. And so simply because you have a mental health problem, which is no different than having a physical problem like diabetes or another type of more visible difference, shouldn't make it so that you're excluded and treated differently. So to the extent that a child with any impairment is able to be in the mainstream environment, they should be. And we've had a lot of very, personally had a lot of very difficult experiences with my son being in classrooms that were special ed classrooms and completely away from the mainstream kids, which was devastating for him, absolutely devastating for him. That being said, there was a period of time when he was so ill that the anxiety that came around being in a mainstream classroom was too intense, and he literally couldn't handle being in a mainstream classroom for many, many years. And they wanted to force him into mainstream when that was not the right thing for him at that time. So that's why I say I have mixed feelings. I do believe in inclusion, but you have to know your own child, and each individual child is different, and sometimes mainstream isn't the answer. Sometimes you do need a special environment depending on the needs, and the hope is that you strengthen that child and help that child to be able to go back into the mainstream environment. I mean, that's the goal always. But I would like to take a more flexible approach and a case-by-case basis and not just have an all-out rule that everyone should be included or everyone should be excluded. Does that make sense?
It does. And it leads me to ask, are there processes now in place to help ease the burden on teachers who just want to teach?
Right. That's an excellent point. That's the other thing. So if you have a child who's severely emotionally dysregulated, how is a teacher in a classroom of 20 to 30 children supposed to manage that? I know that my child, when he was not well, he was a full-time job all by himself. And that it's a huge burden on teachers. And so I would say, again, that's the situation where it's not that children like that should be excluded, but to the degree that they really can't emotionally regulate themselves in a classroom may be a sign that they really aren't ready for that type of environment. There are accommodations that can be put in place to have aids, to have other educational support in the school building to help when a child is, you know, needs a break from a mainstream classroom. And it just depends on the school district and the resources of the school district and do they have the capacity. But it does place a burden on a teacher who's really just trying to get through. What I would say, however, is that teachers don't have the training they need to be able to even recognize or understand what a mental health problem looks like in a classroom. And so a lot of times these kids come off as behavioral problems when really they just don't know how to cope with a certain situation, and the teachers aren't trained properly to know how to handle that. And it doesn't take much to learn about mental health. I'm not proposing that teachers become psychologists or social workers, but just enough information to understand, wait, this kid is having a panic attack. It's not that he's a bad kid, would change a teacher's perspective and maybe ease the burden a bit instead of adding to the behavioral situation by using punishment or threats or ignoring, which is not necessarily the right way to handle a child who's emotionally dysregulated.
Right. I would imagine identification of the issue is a huge part of it. And right. Instead of just calling it a behavioral issue. And as we know, when school districts like the Park City School District dedicate, funding, as I think there was a big wake up call a couple years ago in the in the district, and the superintendent and the school board decided to create that funding for more positions for counselors, which is a wonderful thing. And it all starts with awareness. And that's part of what you're doing when you come to Park City. And in fact, your everyday work is, but we get to have you on Monday, again, October 16th from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. It's at the Community Room at the Park City Library. It's underwritten by both Connect Summit County and the Park City School District. And you'll just be giving people an overview of, I mean, what if someone comes and just says, listen, Randy, I know you've been through it. You've had this in your family. What do I do? You know, what are the first couple things that you say when that happens to you?
So in my workshops, again, my message is to let everybody know that caring for your child's mental health is equally as important as caring for their physical health. But you can't get help for a problem that you don't even know exists in the first place. And so it's really vital that we all become aware of what does mental health mean, and what does mental illness mean, and what does mental wellness mean, and how do we kind of look at all of that together as our children are growing and thriving, and how can we tell the difference between something that's a sign of concern versus just an age-appropriate developmental stage? And this is something I go through in my workshops. Knowledge is power. And if we have the knowledge to understand just the simple basics, and they're not that difficult to learn, then we could completely change the way we view mental health. And my real belief is that early intervention and prevention is possible, but you can't get there if you don't even know that a behavior is a symptom of a mental health condition. If you just think it's, well, I'm a bad parent and that's why my kid behaves that way, or that's what the teachers think, then we're not going to get anywhere. And we wait until crisis intervention and our kids are using drugs. And, you know, then all of a sudden we want to pay attention. It's got to start earlier. We have to start earlier learning more about children's mental health. So that's what I hope will happen. And I have had a lot of success in my workshops during that. So I'm really excited about coming to Park City.
I bet. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Randy Silverman, she'll be in Park City again on Monday, October 16th. Hey, Randy, if someone wants to view your film, is there a means to do that?
Oh, yes. It's called No Letting Go, and it is available on Amazon right now. You can also go onto our website at ymhproject.org, and there is a link to get more information about the film there. And it's I think it was screened in Park City or Salt Lake City last year.
Yeah, in 2016 during May Mental Health Awareness.
Exactly. Yeah. And in fact, I'm going to speak at the Critical Issues Facing Kids and Adolescents Conference in Salt Lake City the day after I'm going to be in Park City.
Wonderful.
Talk about it there. But Amazon. Amazon is the way to get it for now, unless you want to purchase a DVD, which you can do through our website. Amazon, actually, you can get it through Amazon also.
Okay, wonderful. Randy Silverman, thank you so much
Great.
For your time.
Thank you. Really looking forward to coming.
All right. Us too. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow, that'll be great. Again, that's Monday, October 16th, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., the Park City Library Community Room. And that is the Youth Mental Health Project, Randy Silverman. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment, switching gears, going from couch potato to professional cyclist with Phil Gaiman when we return. Stay with us.
KPCW wants to help you decide who to vote for this year's Park City Mayor and City Council. I'm Leslie Thatcher, KPCW News Director.
And I'm Renee Bodley, General Manager. Please join us for a candidate forum this Thursday, October 12th, from 10 to noon.
We'll start with the City Council candidates from 10 to 11.
Then from 11 to noon, the candidates for mayor will be in studio to answer your questions.
Keep it here on KPCW for all of your election coverage.
Made possible by Miller Law Group, providing solutions for divorce, criminal matters, and all things legal. MillerLawUtah.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Graham Anthony. Well, our next guest, Phil Gaiman. was a dedicated couch potato and video game addict. Maybe I'm just calling him an addict. Well, until he decided it was time to come off the couch and hop on a bike just to lose weight. Well, then Phil Gaiman became a pro cyclist. But that's not all. He was a crowd favorite. He's a podcaster, an entrepreneur, an ordained minister, an amateur comedian, and the host of Phil's Cookie Fondo, which raises money for Chef Cycle and No Kid Hungry. He's written an entertaining new book called Draft Animals, Living the Pro Cycling Dream Once in a While. Phil Gaiman, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you. Thank you. And just so you know, anybody could be a minister. It's free. It takes like 10 minutes online.
Well,
so that really shouldn't be on my resume.
You know, I did have that thought run through my head this morning as I was writing this. I thought, I wonder if it's one of those 10-minute things. But hey, good for you, because most of us don't do that.
How many weddings have you performed?
Two.
Excellent.
All right.
Pretty good.
Your best friend and your other best friend.
No divorces yet. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's
good.
2-0
so far.
Nice. Well, you know, here in Park City, we are surrounded by professional and Olympic athletes. And we sort of figure, and we all, you know, of course, we start our children very early because, after all, it takes a lifetime of training and skill building and expertise to become a professional athlete. But I kind of feel like I was attracted to your story because I feel like that's maybe not the way you went. How did you get there?
No, my parents, I grew up in Atlanta, which is not like an endurance athlete community. and my parents were college professors at Georgia Tech. So they weren't pushing me into sports at all. It was something that that sucked me in. I started riding a bike because I loved it, and then I got into racing kind of as a coincidence. I just joined the club in college, and they were more of a racing team, and I just fell into it from there. It's a slippery slope, this sports business.
At one which you discovered very early on that you were well adapted and designed for. Is that right?
Yeah, it was sort of the. I didn't expect to. I was in the club, and I went to a couple of races with my friends, and then turned out to be the first thing that I was ever good at that ever came easy to me. So I kept going, and to the bitter end, it ended up being a decade of my life and racing at the highest level. And then eventually I got to the room of dudes where I wasn't the best anymore, and that's sort of one of the key points in the book is figuring that out and accepting it.
Phil, you and I have something in common. We both arrived in DeKalb County, Georgia, the same year. I was 30 years older than you at the time when you were born. But we also, oddly enough, sort of picked up riding bicycles with high interest at the same time some years later.
Funny. Yeah, congrats on getting out of DeKalb County then.
Thank you very much. I understand you have experience here in Park City with the tour of Utah.
Yeah, absolutely. I've done many, many tours of Utah, many editions of that race, and it's one of my favorites. But there's definitely a few key parts in the book where that take place there. There's a couple kind of one major turning point kind of happens there where I'm going to Europe and I'm kind of trying to figure out what I can salvage of my dreams and if it's worth it and how to move forward. That was 2 years ago.
And tell us a little about
that. The Park City stage was a big part of that. Well, it was I was on one of the best teams in the world, and I kind of like went down. I got to the top level, and I realized at 28, like, oh, I'm not going to be the best. Like, it's something that I think my generation is, you know, you're just waiting to find your superpower, basically, like everyone's a snowflake, that whole millennial thing. And I thought I'd found mine, and it turned out that my superpower got me to, like, probably, like, top 50 in the world at riding a bike up a mountain, which isn't that big of a deal and not much of a superpower. So I had to kind of figure out, like, okay, what is my place in this sport, if any, and what does that mean for my dream and my future? And that was kind of a lot of things coming together, and the tour of Utah was sort of one of the moments where I was particularly faced with that.
Did it have something to do with the 18% grade coming up from Midway? up the backside?
Yeah, that part sucked. The part coming down off of Guardsmen into Park City.
Yeah.
Is every pro cyclist who's done that race, that is the max speed that you reach. And it's every year, it's the same. And like, we all know that descent. Like, I knew it enough. Like, I knew exactly there's one turn you have to kind of break for, but not really. And it goes right into the roundabouts into downtown. Yeah. And I remember just looking down like 72 miles an hour on my bike. And I'm like, this is really going to hurt if I crash here. But there's pizza in the bus. So I just kept going.
Oh, yeah. Seeing the riders come through that roundabout is nothing short of just absolutely horrifying. And, you know, most of us, when we drive down the road, are a little bit worried that perhaps our brakes will go out or something, let alone riding down it. Yeah, I try.
Well, that's why you don't brake. Yeah, that's your first problem.
That's right. Just don't brake. Well, you know, it's
just
so,
let it go.
It's so interesting. I mean, so you had this gift. You happen to be good at cycling, but you came from a very different place. Are you exaggerating that place of being like, you know, hanging out on the couch and playing video games and being overweight? I mean, you couldn't have been huge, right? Give us a little bit of that.
I was high school. This is like age 13 to 15, I think. But I was technically obese, which is 30% body fat. Like, I was right there. I wasn't like disgustingly huge, but I was not like a healthy child. But it's something that like I was able to turn around, not even on purpose. I just kind of changed I just did what I wanted to do. But I turned around probably in like a year. I lost 40 pounds my junior year of high school, just from riding a bike and paying attention to health and eating and a little less Coca-Cola, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Cass County knows what I'm talking about with Coca-Cola, right?
Oh, yeah, from Atlanta. You know, I think this is the most interesting part of your book, because I think what happens in a community like Park City is if you feel like you didn't start, you know, at age 3 on your sport or age 5 or whatever it is, like you missed out. And so that's what I'm so curious about, that you really made this decision when you were, you know, well into your teens, and you turned it around and you became one of the top 50 in the world. And I think that's a really great story, because it's very easy in Park City to feel like, oh, if you're not at the top early, you never will be. So just stay on the couch.
No, it's true. When I started, like the end of my first year, I joined this really small professional team, and everybody else on the team came from like the junior level, which I'd never competed even as a junior. Like I wasn't riding then. But they were all junior national champions, and I'm on a team with all these guys who way better records than me. And within 3 years, they'd all quit, and I was still there. So there's a lot of there's talent, and there's putting in the work, and then there's just like being the guy who doesn't know better than to stop. But I think that's available for everybody. And one of the stories also in the book is a good friend of mine who was on my team for 2 years. Who he started racing a bike. He was a world-class runner and switched to cycling at 23, maybe. He had some ankle issues. He just finished seventh at the Vuelta in Spain, one of the biggest races, one of the big stage races that cycling has. So it's there. It's for a select few, but it's there.
And cycling is no different than any professional level sport. You know, there are millions of golfers who are one stroke away from being a pro, but could never make it as a pro.
Right. It's I was 15 watts from winning the Tour de France. Yeah. You know, I can do 400 watts for an hour. If I could do 415, that's a whole other ball game, and I'm in a much nicer house.
And just for so people know, they can go to your website and see videos of you cranking out 800 and plus watts to this day.
For a minute, yeah.
Yes.
That's my retirement mission has been a YouTube channel called Worst Retirement Ever, because I'm still training too hard, and I go for hill climb records all over the country. I'm gonna get to Park City next year to do one. I'm working on that.
I want to go with you. I've really enjoyed your book, Phil, and I want to start towards the back of it. Your Gaiman's Razor: never attribute to stupidity that which is adequately explained by indifference. I think that wraps up so much of your professional experience, because the least important element in the cycling world is the individual cyclist.
Right. It's a team sport, and that was sort of like the peak of my physical achievement was I got to be like, I got good enough to get bottles for the best guys in the world. That was kind of where I landed. But I overall, like athletes, and you see this if you're more familiar with like the NFL, that the athletes really aren't treated as humans in a lot of ways, and they're kind of disposable. And I found that I was just thrown into whatever race that they needed me. And for a while I sort of took it personal, and I was like, man, they must hate me and they must think I suck. And then I was like, no, they just don't think about me. I was sort of like, I'm that level. I'm like underneath the shoe. And that was how hard I trained to get there. But that's sort of just the reality, and I had to make peace with that.
Yeah, and there are few money players who get all of the attention, and then there's the Peloton. And you do give props to Oprah and Michael Jordan as examples of people who actually rise to the top and stayed there.
Right. Michael Jordan was like as a kid, he was the one I was watching, and he was kind of the, you know, just do it was sort of the message. And then I was kind of like, 10 years later, I'm on a pro team. I'm making $2,000 for the year. That was my salary. And I was sleeping in my car, and I was like, I just did it. So now what? What do I do?
Well, I mean, your book focuses a lot, while being very amusing, it deals with your position, almost not uniquely, but as a transition player from the dopapalics, or you call it, or something to that effect.
The dopocalypse, the aftermath of all the doping scandals. That's a word I made up, so you don't have to pronounce it right.
Yeah, I can't get it. But tell our audience of your tattoo and how that impacted your position in the group.
Sure. When I first started was kind of when all of the fallout came from the Lance Armstrong scandals, and he wasn't the first. A lot of guys kind of came down first, but we sort of knew like, okay, drugs are a bad idea, because we just watched like when I started was when all those guys are just going away, and there were deaths, like it wasn't working out for the people who it had been working out for, and so that was really never part of my equation. But then, because the story of cycling became the scandal and who's on what, and it was always like about to kind of drop the next big scandal. Sponsors ran away, and every year there were fewer and fewer teams, and teams would be winning, teams would be doing well, and then the big sponsor doesn't want to renew. So it was something that like my generation sort of had to take penalty from the crimes of the previous generation. Who those guys were out, you know, they were living in their mansions, and my group sort of had to, well, now I'm racing on no salary and trying to sort of earn cycling's respect back. And so one of the ways that I did that was, I mean, I was just angry in 24, and I'll admit it, I was kind of drunk. I got a tattoo that said clean on my right arm. So it's a bar of soap, and it says clean on it. So it's kind of angled when I post up if I win a race. It's sort of oriented that way. So it was kind of a big F you to those doper guys. But it backfired on me. So it sort of built me a good following. Like American fans kind of liked that. The people who were sick of the whole doping story, they enjoyed my stance and how angry I was. But then a few years later, I kind of got good enough to go to Europe, and I was, you know, I was winning some of the bigger races in the U.S. And I found out that all of the teams over there, all the teams still have dopers on the team, like guys who got away with it and kind of kept quiet, or guys who served a suspension and came back. And then guys who were running the teams were racing that generation and also dopers. And it was kind of like, okay, if I hate all the dopers, then how am I going to get a job among, like, these guys don't want to hire me or sit on the bus with me. So something I had to face too, moving forward at that point was just socially, can I be accepted? Like, I'm good enough, and now, like, can I make them like me enough to take a risk and hire me?
Yeah, that's great. Well, you know, we see here in Park City, you know, someone who's won a gold medal, someone who has achieved a really high level of accomplishment in their sport.
Mm-hmm.
only every so often does the name endure, like a Stein Erickson, for example. And I've always been amazed by him, rest his soul, that he, you know, he was a gold medalist so very long ago, and yet he capitalized on that his whole life, and he was revered and honored, and, you know, people loved him. But it doesn't happen to every gold medal winner, and yet you, one tier down from the top, as you say, the guy who can get the bottles for the top guys, you're making a go of it. You have a podcast, you're writing books, and I just love it. I mean, explain.
Thanks.
Your...
Yeah, I'm trying. I don't know. I wanted to sort of use my English degree, and I like telling stories, and I sort of... There was a point when I realized that I wasn't that good of a bike racer, that I wasn't going to win the Tour de France. I was kind of like, okay, is there a point? Like, what can I do what is the thing that I can do that's better than anybody else can do? And it's like, well, I'm the only guy in the World Tour who can write a book.
Yeah.
So I did that. I was like, okay, here's something that only I can do, and that someone will enjoy and will be impactful. So I kind of got into that, and since then it's been other kinds of media with my YouTube channel and my podcast. And this year I've just sort of been experimenting, and I'll see what works, and circle back and try and keep it doing better.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us. The book is Draft Animals, Living the Pro Cycling Dream Once in a While. Our guest is Phil Gaiman. He's also the author of the cult favorites, Pro Cycling on $10 a Day and Ask a Pro. And a really delightful story. Thanks for joining us on The Mountain Life. And come see us. We are very near that roundabout, like potato launching distance from that roundabout,
funny.
Here at KPCW.
Call us when you're in town.
Okay,
we'll bake cookies.
Good. I'll come get Empire Pass, and then I'll come hang out.
Okay.
What's the coffee place in Park City I like?
Is it
Atticus?
There's Chocolates.
Ritual.
Yeah, Ritual,
yeah.
Chocolate. Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
We'll go there.
Okay. Sounds
and
good.
We'll make cookies.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
Sounds good. Thank you, guys.
And again, Draft Animals, Phil Gaiman. I really love his story, and I have to say I turned down the interview solicitation a couple of times because I thought, we know this story. We have all these people here in Park City. But it was really a different sort of story, and he's a great writer. And
it's a fun book. I recommend it.
Yeah. And he, I forgot the guy's name, and maybe you can help me, you know, on the Tour de France commentators, the guy, Bob, I can't believe I'm forgetting his name.
Can't help you here.
Okay. Well, he was once a pro cyclist on the 7-Eleven team, I think. And then he went on to make this great career for himself, being a pretty entertaining commentator for pro cycling.
Very entertaining.
I can't believe I can't remember his name. Someone's going to text me. What's his name? Well, this is The Mountain Life. Want to thank our underwriters today. Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Phil Davidson Orthopedics, Park City Mountain, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Zions Bank, Fairway Independent Mortgage, and Valley Behavioral Health.
Spend the day outdoors at Utah Olympic Park. Save when you buy a gold pass. Valid for unlimited day use of the zip lines, adventure courses, and much more. Activities are open Saturday and Sunday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. until October 22nd. Details at UtahOlympicLegacy.org.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities and a KPCW supporter.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com.
And it's KPCW Park City. Thanks, Steve and Katie. Bob Roll.